The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest this week is Rebecca Rothstein. She's an expert in exercise and Pilates, especially how to use Pilates to prevent osteoporosis. If you look at the calendar, we're popping right here into February, which means just 2 months away, we have to go through this annual ritual we all do of filing our taxes. Someday Congress may wake up and realize that a simpler tax system would be much benefit for the country. But I'm sure as a result of Obamacare and tax law changes going into effect after 2012, many Americans are finding themselves in higher tax brackets. And the Democrats are now talking about new taxes to pay for new spending programs such as free college for everyone if they are elected. So we're going to focus today on tax planning and how you can use different strategies to lower your tax bill. After all, the more money you save, that move dollars into your pocket to spend or to save towards your retirement. You are not obligated to pay more than you have to. It is legitimate to try to avoid taxes as opposed to evade them. And you owe it to yourself to save taxes. Those tax savings help you reach your retirement goals sooner. So if you're expecting to make more money, you plan to retire or get married this year or make a major life change, listen up, because this show is going to be packed with information. So I guess, Jim, every year there are tax changes. Congress can't just resist putting its little fingers in there doing things. So let's look at the changes that have gone into effect for 2016 to start with. That'll give us a base platform.
Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of them. And let's begin with what changed for 2016. First of all, guess what? John, you don't have to file by April 15th. They're going to extend that to April 18th of this year.
Is that a woohoo? You know, woohoo!
You get 3 more days before you cut the check. You know, celebrate.
Okay, yeah, all right.
So the tax day is going to be extended to April 18th. And bad news, if you're out there, if you're single, let's say a young person, and you don't have health care, those tax penalties related to Obamacare are going up again. The Affordable Care Act imposed penalties for those not having qualified health care coverage. Now, those penalties started at around $95, roughly about 1% of your income, and then they rose to $285 or 2% of your income for 2016. Guess what, folks? They're going from $285. The penalty hits $695 or 2.5% of your income. The maximum per person will be $2,085. So, folks, this is going up. So if you don't have health care insurance, you're going to end up paying close to $700 when you file your tax return. And this is one, John, there's a lot of people out there that are really not paying much attention to this, because I don't know about you. When I was young, I didn't have health care. You know, when you're in your 20s, you think you're going to live forever and you're perfectly healthy. You're not thinking about that. I didn't get my first health care program until I started working for an employer. So if you're single out there, just remember, it's going to cost you $700. So that was the second change. Tax brackets are going up slightly. We'll get to those later on in the program. The bracket amounts are going up about 0.4%. So no big deal here. Standard deductions are going up for head of household. So if you're a single parent, that standard deduction goes up $50 to $9,300. Personal exemptions are rising. They're going to be $4,050 for everyone. So pay attention to that, because as we get later on into tax planning, depending on what your income is, you could actually be losing your personal exemptions and some of your itemized deductions. They begin phasing out at lower levels. We'll get to that later on in the program. Number six, contribution limits on health savings accounts are going up for 2016. And individual policies will be $3,350. The maximum contribution for a family will rise to $6,750. The earned income tax credit is rising. The maximum credit will be $6,269. That's up about $27. Those with two children will get a maximum of $5,572. So that was number seven. Number eight, the exemption from AMT is higher. Now, if you're not familiar with AMT, if you have a lot of itemized deductions or tax shelters, the government does two calculations. They subtract a lot of things out of your deductions and your tax shelters. And if the tax is higher, then you pay what is called the alternative minimum tax, which is a rate of 28%. The AMT exemption goes up $300. The AMT phase-out starts at $53,900. And all the way up to $83,809. The estate tax exemption is heading up. It was last year $5,430,000. It goes up an extra $20,000 to $5,450,000. If you're married and have a living trust, an AB trust, you can shelter now $10.9 million without paying estate taxes. And then there were a lot of tax provisions that were renewed. For example, if you're age 70 and you want to pass $100,000 distribution out of your IRA to a charity, that got extended. So there were a lot of things that were extended there. But as you can see, just like anything, it's a big business. There's always changes in the tax code. Just be aware of those.
Okay, well, besides the Obamacare insurance penalties going into effect, there was a bit of good news. At least tax brackets were adjusted upward to take into account inflation. So what is the first step to take when you're trying to make an effort to lower your taxes?
Don't pay them.
Well, I was going to suggest that. I was going to say other than tax evasion. So, all right, we've stepped through that one. Now, you might want to tell people that there are some usual deleterious side effects to not paying your tax bill, among which are long prison terms and other things related to that.
Yeah, you can change pinstripes for orange stripes.
There you go.
So,
yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get serious here. The first step is finding your marginal tax bracket. And this is really an important number. If you're saving for retirement, you're in retirement, and maybe later on we'll be taking distributions from a pension plan. What this really does, it dictates how much tax planning you need to do. It also tells you what your next taxable dollar. In other words, if you get one more dollar of income this year, let's say your employer gives you a raise, that's the rate on which that additional income is going to be taxed at. So you want to find out your federal tax bracket as well as your state tax bracket if you live in a state that has income taxes. The two brackets combined is the number you need to know because it is the rate you're going to pay on that next dollar of income that you make. It is also a helpful guide as to the other type of investments you should be making if you're saving for retirement or you're in retirement, how your portfolio should be efficiently allocated. And, you know, when you think about it, the top federal tax rate is 39.6, but they start phasing out your itemized deductions. There's additional Medicare taxes and a jump in that Medicare tax of almost 1% depending on your income. And then the phase out of your exemptions and itemized deductions. So the top federal rate is 44%. Or if you live in the highest tax state in the country, like I do in California, the top income tax rate here is 13.3. So take 44 federal, 13.3, that's 57.3. The government is actually taking almost 60% of your income. Now you know why when athletes hit it big like Tiger Woods, they move out of the state of California. We'll be discussing that option with a case study at the end of today's program.
Okay, so where do you find the number and then how do you know which numbers cross through what brackets?
You can go to a tax form. You can just Google the 1040 form. And basically, it is on the back page. It's line number 43. It's called taxable income. It is the same item on your state tax return. So you want to look for the words taxable income. This is after all your exemptions, deductions, you arrive at that number. Now, there's a couple other items that follow. You could have an AMT tax or you could have, for example, tax credits if you got solar or something else. But usually it's taxable income. And then what you want to do is go to the tax tables.
Assuming you find your taxable income, Jim, the next step in the process.
Well, then what you want to do is you want to go to the federal tax tables, and you need to know what it is for 2016, because you want to make sure you look at the 2016 rates, because they did go up just a small amount, not much, because there wasn't much inflation. But since Obamacare, you need to know that there are three tax brackets you need to be made aware of. Your top tax bracket is what we call the marginal tax bracket. That's what your next dollar of additional income, let's say you get a bonus, maybe you get a raise, that's what that money is going to be taxed at. That's your marginal rate. The second tax bracket you need to be aware of is the limitation on itemized deductions. Once you get to a certain level, the government starts subtracting your itemized deductions and your exemptions. So you start losing those. And then the third bracket is the Obamacare investment tax on investments. That's a 3.8% additional tax on all forms of income from investments and in capital gains. And also there's a bracket in which you pay an additional Medicare tax of 0.9%. So it's not just one tax bracket you need to be aware of. It's multiple brackets. Unfortunately, since Obamacare has passed, you now have three brackets you have to be concerned, because different kind of taxes kick in. One bracket, as I mentioned, is your marginal tax bracket. That's what the next dollar is taxed at. That is what you're going to pay on the next dollar of income you earn. So if you're thinking of getting a bonus, or you just got good news, your boss is giving you a raise, that marginal tax bracket is what you're going to end up paying on the federal level. Now, the next two brackets determine where you start to lose part of your itemized deductions, or they start to phase out your personal exemptions. At one level, they start subtracting 3% of your adjusted gross income, and they subtract that number from your itemized deductions. So it's another way of increasing your tax. I think the net effect is a 1.4% increase in your taxes. The final bracket determines what tax you pay on capital gains and investments. I don't care if it's rental income, if it's income from annuities, it's interest income, it's dividends, capital gains. There's an additional Medicare surtax at 3.8%. So, John, you can see here tax planning has become more complex and confiscatory after especially the Tax Reform Act of 2012, which raised rates, and then Obamacare, which started to phase out personal deductions, exemptions, and also added additional taxes on investment income and additional Medicare tax. So as bad as it sounds, it could actually get much worse depending on election results, as Democrats are calling for higher income tax rates, higher capital gains rate of 28%, investment taxes, and a new wealth tax, and a possible higher estate tax. This is the campaign rhetoric, depending on who you're listening to, that's running on the Democratic side. Bernie Sanders wants tax rates back up to 90% and doesn't want to allow people to make more than $1 million. Good luck with trying to get that through. But anyway, right now, investors and retirees need to be aware of, there are three different tax brackets you have to be aware of, because each one of those brackets start at different levels of income, and they're going to add to your tax bracket. In other words, you take your regular tax rate, you start phasing out your itemized deductions, start phasing out your exemptions, then you throw in an additional almost 1% Medicare tax on top of the 2.8% Medicare tax that kicks in after you exceed your Social Security base. And John, you can see how these taxes start to add up and how complex this is becoming.
Well, so you know your number now, then what do you do to reduce your taxes and then bring the tax bill down correspondingly?
Cry a lot, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, think about it, 57.3% here in California. That's confiscatory.
Right.
Anyway, you want to get as much as you can to reduce your adjusted gross income. Now, if you're not familiar with that figure, the reason it's important, because it kicks in where other taxes could come in terms of, let's say, phasing out your itemized deductions and the other things we talked about. So it's a very important number that you want to get. It's the number on the bottom of the front page of your 1040 tax return. So the number, you know, that's really a big number now, because it really has to do with what you're going to be able to deduct on your itemized deductions, your exemptions, your Medicare tax, your investment surtax, and capital gains. And the tax rates are based off that number. So the biggest impact that you can make if you're doing tax planning is to reduce your adjusted gross income. That's the figure on the front page of your tax return. It's line item number 37. If you just download and Google a 1040 tax form, there's only the front and back page of that form you need to learn about to follow along with the discussion that we're making. But that line item, adjusted gross income, on the bottom of the front page is very, very important, because two other kind of taxes that could possibly kicked in are based on what that number is.
Right. Well, what sort of strategies can be used to do just that? I mean, are they different for, let's say, an employee versus a person that is self-employed? That's always a marked difference.
There's two things you can do on the front page of your tax return. The first category is income. Government wants to know your income from all sources. I don't care if it's wages, business, investments, IRAs, unemployment, Social Security, you name it, they want it. And one strategy is to reduce the first item that is on your tax return. It's called wages, salaries, and tips. And the way you can do that is if you're at work and you have something like a 401k program, if you're a teacher, a 403b, if you're in government, a 457 plan, because what that does, it reduces your taxable income, which is going to reduce your adjusted gross income. The second thing that you can do is reduce your taxable income. Now, you can do that by, for example, investing in tax-free bonds versus taxable bonds, or if you have qualified dividends. If you invest in a dividend stock, it's taxed at 15% or 20%, depending on which bracket. So dividends are taxed at a lower tax bracket than regular interest. The other things that you have, if you have capital loss, business loss, you can deduct up to $3,000 a year against your gross income if you have capital losses. Let's say you sold some stock at a loss or something at a loss. The other kind of things are called adjustments to adjusted gross income. And they're mainly type of health expenses. There's things like educator expenses, a health savings account. If you are self-employed and contributing to a SEP or a simple IRA, IRAs, penalties on early withdrawal from savings, student loan interest deduction, tuition and fees. So there are a number of things that you can do, but your most effective thing that you can do when you're planning to reduce your taxes is all on that front page, because itemized deductions are getting harder to come by. They're starting to phase them out. They're trying to limit them. And eventually, I think they're going to end up phasing them out. When you hear them talk about tax reform or tax preference items, they're really talking about doing away with itemized deductions. These strategies that I mentioned all reduce the bottom line number, which is that number on the bottom of the front page of your tax return. And this is where you are going to save the most when it comes to tax planning and lowering your tax bill.
Well, for clarity for our listeners, why don't you go through the tax brackets that are really key here for single and married taxpayers, especially the ones that impact, say, for example, deductions, exemptions, capital gains, and investment taxes, because I think the contrast here is important.
Okay, I'm going to take three brackets, and let's start with a single individual. And there's three brackets you need to be aware of. At $415,050, you move from the 35% bracket to the 39.6% bracket. In addition to that, you pay an additional 5% on capital gains and dividends. So your dividend and your capital gains tax goes from 15 to 20, and your income tax bracket goes by 5%. The second bracket you need to be aware of your single is $259,400. At that level of income, they start to phase out your personal exemptions, and they take 3% of your adjusted gross income and subtract it from your itemized deductions. That's the second bracket you need to be aware of. That came in with Obamacare. The third bracket you need to be aware of, if you're single, is $200,000. If you have $200,000 or more, you pay the Obamacare surtax of 3.8% on all your investment income in capital gains. So you could potentially be paying 23.8% on capital gains and 23.8% on dividends. So those are the three brackets if you're single. If you're married, you hit the 39.6 bracket at income of $466,950. You hit the phase out of exemptions and deductions at $311,300. And you pay the Obamacare surtax on investment income at $250,000. The $200,000 and $250,000 number for single and married is not indexed to inflation. So those are some really important numbers. Three different brackets. A lot of people, when they passed the tax reform bill in 2012, it was $400,000 for a single individual. It's now $415,000. It was $450,000 for a married couple. It's now almost $467,000. And people said, see, it really doesn't impact you unless you make those kind of numbers. That's not true, because Obamacare brought in two additional tax brackets for the phase out of exemptions and deductions, and also Medicare tax of additional 0.9%, and the Obamacare surtax on investments of 3.8%.
Well, it's very obvious here then that anything you can do to reduce your AGI, your adjusted gross income, will have the greatest impact on your taxes. So what we should do is spend a few moments and talk about these briefly, because you've covered a lot of ground here, not to mention the multiple complexity of different tax brackets, which actually force you to pay higher taxes. This is why it's so hard to do tax planning, Jim, is this thing is so complicated, and Congress, knowing that, keeps making it more complicated, but we're stuck with it.
I know. I mean, Obamacare threw in, you know, there's actually a fourth table, which is the AMT table, but there's really three brackets that you really have to be concerned about. Before Obamacare, there was one tax bracket. And before the tax reform bill, it was, you know, the top bracket was 35%. There were six brackets going all the way down from 10%. So the tax rates became less progressive. Now they're very, very progressive in nature. Plus, there's two additional brackets that you have to be made aware of. Now, I mentioned earlier, the most effective thing that you can do is to lower your adjusted gross income. And the reason being are those other two Obamacare tax brackets that phase out exemptions, deductions, and then also the investment surtax. Now, one way to do that is if you're at work, you should be contributing to some kind of retirement savings plan, a 401k, a 403b, or 457, because that reduces taxable income. It's probably the most effective thing that you can do, because you're going to have the greatest impact. Just to give you an example, this year, you can put up to $18,000 in a 401k program. If you're over age 50, you can add an additional $5,000 to that. So the number is $23,000. If you're contributing to a SEP, it's $53,000. So one effective thing to do is use tax deferral and reduce your taxable income through contributions to some kind of pension plan. Another thing that's very effective is tax-free interest. And folks, it really pays to know what your tax bracket is, because many of you are investing in taxable investments when you really would be better off in today's high tax bracket environment in tax-free bonds. Another thing, dividends have a special tax rate. They're 15%, as low as 10%, depending on your income, and can go up to 20%. That certainly beats 39.6. So dividends are taxed at a lower income. If you are self-employed, there's some good news. You can really salt away a lot of money. Take something like a SEP program where you put away $53,000, defined benefit plans where you can put away hundreds of thousands of dollars, things like health savings accounts, or even an IRA. You know, one of the things that I follow the Warren Buffett rule. If you look at Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway, he gets a lot of his income. Warren Buffett's primary source of income is dividends and capital gains. So he's only paying a 20% tax rate, now 23.8 under Obamacare. But he also invests in tax-free bonds. So you can reduce your taxable income by making sure your investments have tax preference to them. I mean, that's what I do. I mean, everything I do in life is either tax sheltered through rental properties, sheltered with depreciation, or master limited partnerships, which shelter part of the dividends, or dividends, which are taxed at a lower rate, or tax-free bonds. Because, you know, here in California, combining 13.3% tax rate to a federal 44, you're in a 57% tax bracket. So, you know, you want to make your investments, you want to do what Warren Buffett does, which is what I do, which is make your investment income taxed at a lower rate. And that's one of the reasons Warren Buffett is as wealthy as he is. He is chairman of the 10th largest market cap company on the S&P 500, but pays himself a salary of $100,000, because that salary, he knows what could be in his bracket if he was paid like a normal CEO, he would be in that 44% federal bracket. Instead, Warren Buffett last year had $59 million of taxable income taxed at the 23.8% bracket because it was primarily dividends, capital gains, or tax-free income.
Okay, now what about itemized deductions? That's your Schedule A that usually factors in on the back page of the tax return.
Itemized deductions are things that your mortgage interest that you pay on your home, a home equity line of credit is deductible, your state taxes that you pay, medical expenses if they exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. Once again, there's that important figure again, adjusted gross income. Miscellaneous deductions if they exceed 2.5% of your adjusted gross income, things like charitable contributions, losses from property and casualty. Let's say you had a storm damage your home and you had out-of-pocket losses. Those are mainly your itemized deductions. And once again, you can lose part of those. You know, part of your itemized deductions are based on your adjusted gross income. So once again, why that adjusted gross income figure on the front page of your tax return is so important. Now, if you don't have enough deductions to itemize, you might want to consider bunching them up together, like maybe paying, as a lot of people did, you know, they paid their 2016 property tax bill in December, so they bunched their deductions all in one year to get a higher deduction in order to itemize.
Okay, now, what about state taxes? What can you do there? One suggestion I could suggest is move. Believe it or not, it's really
We're going to get to that, buddy.
Okay, all right. Okay, so what do we do?
Well, I mean, every state is a little different in terms of what they allow or follow in terms of federal law. Not everything that is allowable under federal law is allowable under state law, California being a good example. It's probably one of the worst, and it has the country's highest tax rate. Now, one strategy we're using for our wealthy clients is to use what is called tax inversion, which, John, relates to what you just said. In planning for retirement, basically move. If you are living in a high tax state like Oregon, Hawaii, New York, California, you know, basically you might want to consider moving to a state with no income taxes or a state that has much lower income taxes. And I'll discuss this in this week's case study. But some states like California are welfare states, generous government salaries and pensions, which almost bankrupted the state a while back. They were lucky with the social media explosion in technology. California made billions of dollars off IPOs of a lot of these social media companies. And of course, an expanding economy helped bring some of that deficit down with two tax hikes, one in 2010, where they raised tax rates to 10.3, and then they lowered the brackets and raised them to 13.3 in 2012. But I believe eventually states like California, states like Illinois with their pensions, or New Jersey are going to run into bankruptcies in the next downturn. So the best strategy, which works for retirement or work, if you can work anywhere you want, is to retire in a tax-free state or a state with, let's say, no taxes. Now, the tax-free states are Alaska, might be a little bit cold, Florida, Nevada, South Dakota, Texas, Washington, and Wyoming. Now, there's two other states, New Hampshire and Tennessee, that only tax interest and dividends. If you're looking for a low tax state, Arizona has a tax rate of 4.5%. North Dakota 3.2, Illinois 3.75%, Indiana 3.3%, Pennsylvania a little over 3%, and Colorado 4.6%. So you've got basically nine states that have no income tax, and you've got probably six states that have low income taxes. So you've got about 15, 20 states that you can move to that can have a dramatic impact. I mean, you know, what was the first thing Tiger Woods did when he went pro is he moved from California to Florida. A lot of athletes and entertainers live there as well because Florida doesn't have an income tax. You know, you can't move out of the country. You know, the U.S. is one of the few countries in the world that tax your global income. Doesn't matter if you're moving outside of the country or you live outside the country, you still owe federal taxes. You can't escape it. But what you can do is reduce your state taxes.
Okay, so states and their income tax brackets are something that you can control if you plan to retire. I mean, if you're in a high tax state, then you move to a no tax or low tax state. Although there's a slight caveat here, Jim, because sometimes the no tax states have much higher sales taxes. So the cost of living goes up on the other side.
Or even property taxes.
Or property tax, right. They have to make it up somewhere. That's something you can't do at the federal level. So sum up what we've discussed today. Let's look at this again. Overall, you need to know what your marginal tax rate is, as if it tells you what your next dollar of income is going to be taxed at. Once you know that number, you can take steps to reduce your taxable income by using favorable investments such as dividend stocks, tax-free bonds, or sheltered income from real estate or MLPs. But everyone should be using tax reduction strategies such as a pension plan, a 401k. The more you reduce your taxable income, the less you become susceptible to the other taxes like the Obama taxes through a loss of itemized deductions or the surtax on investments or higher Medicare taxes. You know, this is bewildering. It's amazing when you think about it that we go through this.
Oh, it's no wonder the tax planning industry is thriving. I mean, Obamacare really made the tax code quite complex. I mean, it was bad enough when you just had to worry about your marginal tax bracket. Now you have all these other different brackets that kick in at lower levels of income that serve what I call the gotcha tax. I mean, imagine a lot of the single individuals this year, they're going to wake up and when they file their tax return are finding out they owe $700 because they didn't have any health insurance. I mean, that's going to come as a whopping surprise to a lot of people, but they won't find out about it until April of 2017 after the elections.
Well, it would seem what's important is to have some sort of a plan, because the less you pay in taxes, as you've said before, the more money you line in your pockets to spend or to save towards retirement. I mean, it does have a cascading effect forward that's positive. Okay, let's do a case study right here, since we've been talking about tax reduction. As with all our case studies every week on lifetime income, they're all based on a real life study, but we changed the names to protect the people involved. Okay, they're people, they're artificial names, of course, and the circumstances.
This week's case study is Joe and Meredith Whitney. Joe is age 61. He's a geologist at a major integrated oil company. His wife, Meredith, is a teacher's aide. Her age was 57. Now, Joe's age 61. The idea is to retire at age 62. His salary currently is $275,000 a year plus bonus and stock options. Meredith's salary as a teacher's aide is roughly about $24,000 a year. So both of them making good levels of income, mainly coming from Joe's salary. Their home in San Ramon is roughly about $1.3 million. It was free and clear. Joe had a deferred comp with the company, $900,000. It was one of the main things he did to reduce his income. Remember when I talked about reducing your taxable income? Well, he would get a bonus, and his oil company had a tax deferred program. So instead of taking the bonus and paying the tax on it, he put it in a deferred comp program, which saved him a lot of money. That deferred comp program was worth about $900,000. His company stock, now valued about $700,000. Believe it or not, at one time that was over $1 million. His pension and 401k was roughly about $1.7 million, had about $230,000 in cash, and his wife Meredith's 403b plan was roughly about $34,000, so roughly almost about $4.9 million in assets. Their tax bracket, and here was the problem, they were in a federal tax bracket, even putting money in a 401k, which he maxed, which was $23,000 a year, even putting his bonus in a deferred comp program. The Whitneys were still in a 33% federal tax bracket, 9.3% federal tax bracket. Their combined tax bracket was 42.3%. And that was basically, they were sheltering well over $50,000 a year with his deferred comp, his 401k, and the 403b plan. So had he not been doing that, he would have been closer to the 35% bracket, and possibly, depending on stock options and what he did, he could have gone up into that 39% bracket. Their annual expenses, and this goes to show you how important tax planning is, their annual expenses were $150,000. Their single largest expense was federal and state taxes. Last year, in 2014, they paid $51,452 on the federal side, $17,512 on state, for a total of $68,964. Roughly 46% of their spending came from taxes, both federal and state. So you can see taxes. And John, here was a couple that was doing everything they possibly could. They didn't have any itemized deductions. Well, they had a little, but they were phasing part of those out based on their income because their house was free and clear. So the only thing he had was his property taxes of roughly about $15,000 a year and roughly about almost $18,000 in state taxes. And then they had two exemptions, which were being phased out.
Okay, well, then what was the plan that you worked out given these circumstances?
They both felt it was time to retire. They wanted to travel. Their kids lived on, one of their sons was working for the same oil company. He was stationed overseas. They wanted a lot more travel. So the plan was to retire at age 62, which would be 1 year from now. And we recommended that they move back to where the company was located in Texas, you know, because Texas has no state income taxes. I mean, that alone was going to save them roughly $18,000. The other thing too, looking into Texas, they could get a house there for about $500,000 selling their house here, which is worth about $1.3 million. So that would free up about $700,000 in cash. Now, what we recommended is he had a deferred comp program. You could take it in a lump sum, which would be crazy, spread it out over 5 years or 10 years. We recommended that he take his deferred compensation program, spread it out over a 10-year period, which would basically be an annual income of $90,000 for about a 10-year period. We wanted to take any cash that was freed up from the sale of the house and the difference between the house they would purchase in Texas. They were looking in the Austin, Texas area. They had friends there. Didn't want to go back to Houston because it was a little bit too much humid there. But also, we recommend that Joe would roll over his 401k pension plan into an IRA rollover. The same thing with Meredith's, basically a 403b plan. And we also recommended, because he was going to be receiving deferred comp of roughly about 90 grand a year over a 10-year period, that he, number one, not take his Social Security at age 66, allow that to accumulate at 8% a year. So at age 70, his Social Security income would be roughly about $43,000 a year. Meredith would be entitled to half of that. So that would be about another almost $22,000 a year. Basically, because they would be saving a lot more income, and because of the way they lived, because we were going to reduce their taxes, because he would no longer have the high earned income that he has while he was working, because his deferred comp would be taxable. So here's what it would look like at age 73. So the immediate plan at age 62, roll over his pension and not touch it to age 70, defer taking Social Security to age 70 and a half, free up the money between his sale of his house and what he would purchase, and put that into municipal bonds. Now, the way it would look like, assuming another 8 years of accumulation, at retirement, he would have Social Security income of $43,000, which 85% of that would be taxable. Meredith's Social Security, which would be half of Joe's, would be $21,500. 85% of that would be taxable. He would have roughly $30,000 of tax-free income from municipal bonds at a zero tax rate, so none of that would be taxable. The dividends from his company stock, we didn't want to sell that. I'll tell you why in a moment here, would be roughly $54,000. That would be taxed at 15%. And then at age 70, when he would be required to take income out of his IRA, that would be roughly about $63,000. He would be in a 25% tax bracket at that time. So total income about $211,000. Now, since they were close to $5 million, we recommended that they get something called a disclaimer trust, which would allow him the flexibility to have a double exemption should his assets one day exceed over $5 million at the rate they save. That would certainly be the case. The other thing that we wanted to do is we would keep the company stock until one of them passed away, most likely Joe, because it would get a stepped up basis in cost at that time. All the capital gains would be forgiven. We would sell three quarters of it at that time and put it in a tax-free bond because as a single surviving spouse, assuming that's Meredith in this case, she would be in a much higher tax bracket than what they would be as a married couple. But we didn't want to sell this stock now because it was paying a good dividend. It was taxed at 15%. But later on, when Meredith, let's assume she's their survivor, she would move into a higher tax bracket and we could eliminate the capital gains at Joe's death. So basically, John, the strategy that we used here, tax-free, which were tax-free municipal bonds, tax deferral, which was deferring the pension plan into an IRA rollover until age 70, and then tax inversion, which was moving from a high tax state here in California, where he was taxed at 9.3%, to Texas, where he's taxed at 0%.
So with proper planning, it is possible to do what you need to do to reduce your taxes, which is a very important part of any kind of planning, retirement or estate or otherwise. Coming up next here on Lifetime Income, Rebecca Rothstein, an expert in exercise and Pilates, especially how to use Pilates to prevent osteoporosis as Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, exercises for osteoporosis are a confusing subject. There are exercises for prevention, there are exercises for rehab. And when osteoporosis is present, there's always the issue of exercise safety. Joining me on the program today is Rebecca Rothstein. She's an expert in osteoporosis, bone health, and Pilates. Rebecca, let's start with your own personal situation. I guess in your life, you had osteoporosis. How did you arrive at Pilates and develop the programs that you currently lead now?
Well, Jim, it's actually a little bit of a reverse story for me. I was already a Pilates instructor, and then I found out that I had osteoporosis. So it all really starts way back when I was a ballet dancer many years ago. And this is not an uncommon phenomenon that, like many high-level athletes, women who are ballet dancers are predisposed to osteoporosis because of their low weight, perhaps nutrition, their size, etc. So once I had quit and I was already a Pilates instructor, I learned that I had osteoporosis and I was already doing teacher training and knew about osteoporosis, but I really changed my path to specialize in it at that point.
Now, you were a Pilates instructor before that. I know that depending on what Pilates studio you go to, some specialize in doing mat work. Others specialize in the different forms of Pilates equipment from reformers, Cadillacs, chairs. And gosh, you go to some of these Pilates manufacturers today and they're coming out with all new kinds of contraptions. So when you talk about Pilates and especially the kind of work that you do, we've heard about weight-bearing exercises help prevent osteoporosis. How does it do that? And specifically, Contrast, let's say, doing Pilates with, let's say, weightlifting equipment.
Sure. Well, let's first back up to explain about Pilates. So there are so many different styles, so to speak, when you hear about people teaching Pilates, that they all should have still the same cornerstone principles: breathing, coordination, centering, control, precision, flow. Those are considered these principles of Pilates. So that should be a unifying thread wherever you go, whether you're using equipment, whether you're just doing it on the mat. The types of exercises that people are doing, there's a standardization, but there are so many different exercises that many people are now bringing in. However, when we talk about how weight bearing comes in and what that means, let me explain that. There's something called Wolf's Law, which basically is a phenomenon that explains that bone is sensitive to external forces. It will reshape itself. It'll alter its mass, its structure in response. It's kind of like the way that your muscles change in their shape when you exercise, when you work out. So bone is living tissue and it does the same thing. And specifically, there are different techniques that are useful. One is called weight bearing, which is literally just bearing or using your body's weight. So when you're standing, when you're walking, you're doing weight bearing movement. Also, when you're on all fours, that's weight bearing for your wrist. So it's not just in a standing position. The other way that bone will remodel itself and basically reinforce itself is through resistance exercise. So that's when your muscles are pulling against the bone. There is a fortification or reinforcement that occurs. So whenever you're lifting weights, for instance, you're doing that. Whenever you're using stretch bands, your muscles are activating. Whenever you're doing, say, even like a yoga exercise or a push-up, you're using your own body's weight, but your muscles are still working. You're getting resistance. So you can be doing with Pilates something that's unique that doesn't happen in a lot of other techniques, especially when you're using the equipment, for instance, is that you don't have to be weight-bearing to get the external force. There are springs that will make your muscles work. But you can also do Pilates without equipment. So, for instance, some of the mat work, you're getting your muscles to be working against gravity. So that is one way that makes Pilates possibly different from other modalities. Another thing, though, that I would like to mention is that the beauty of Pilates is the control component. So much of the focus occurs on the lengthening phase of a muscle, and the control is really critical also for balance. And we've seen in research how muscular control can also help your balance. And balance is a really important factor for osteoporosis, because the danger about osteoporosis is the possibility of fracture. And if you fall, you have a much more likelihood of fracturing.
You know, you talk about osteoporosis, but we see this in aging as individuals get into their 70s and 80s. We hear about, you know, older people falling, breaking their hips. It's also important in the aging process to not only keep your bones strengthened, but also to keep that flexibility so you don't, let's say, have the propensity to fall and injure yourself. Let's talk about that and how Pilates is very useful in keeping, maintaining not only bone health, but also flexibility.
Absolutely. Well, you know, as we're talking about the risk of falling, it's interesting because so many people think about osteoporosis as a concern for the elderly. But it's estimated that 1 in 2 women and 1 in 4 men over 50 will break a bone from osteoporosis. And the most common area of fracture in the early postmenopausal area, so we're talking like women in their 50s, is fracturing a wrist. And guess how that happens? It's not because they can't stand. It's because they trip on something. And so balance comes into play, but not just balance, but also stimulating your reflexes. So if you start to fall off balance, can you catch yourself before you fall, right? So what's your reaction time? How quickly are you able to recover? Your recovery speed is really what we should call it. So Pilates is very useful because it is a full body exercise. So, you know, people think so much about the core. There's that term, this ubiquitous phrase, the core now. And it really was meant to be referring to the musculature of the trunk and the abdomen. So the abdominals, the low back, the pelvic muscles, the breathing muscles as well. So that is certainly a primary component of Pilates. It gives you that sense of control. But there's also an aspect of flexibility, and all the movements are full body. So you're not just working just the abdominals, for instance. It's not like you're just doing a crunch. There is intention throughout the entire body. And so your feet are never just dangling. They're always active. And the feet are your contact point with the ground as well, which will also help you in terms of balance. But flexibility, as you say, comes in as well. And part of this is because it's Pilates is a whole body movement form, but also it goes back to what I was saying before of the lengthening phase of muscles, which is really where they get their strongest. And that's also where you can change the resting length of a muscle. And that's where people think of the quote flexibility. And here's another example for you. Say that I'm asking you to do what we call safe movement, and I'll come back to that in a little bit. In other words, I want you to be picking something off the ground in a safe manner, just in like your regular daily activities. That's going to require a certain amount of flexibility if I'm asking you not to bend through your back. That means that you're going to have enough hip mobility and range of motion at your ankle in order to do that. So it's not just, oh, can I touch the floor with my hand with straight knees? You know, that's what I think people often think about is flexibility. I think of flexibility is as much more than that. It's agility, and it's your ability to perform your daily activities safely, whether that's playing with your children or grandchildren, whether that's cleaning your house, whether it's picking up your groceries.
I know a lot of Pilates movements sometimes resemble some of the movements that you see in yoga. Contrast, let's say, Pilates versus yoga, because sometimes a lot of the movements look the same.
They do, and I think there's a good reason for that. Well, yoga's been around for thousands of years, but Pilates was developed by a man named Joseph Pilates, who really cultivated his system during the First World War. He was in an internment camp overseas. He started looking at ways to strengthen the body, particularly for the sick inmate. But also, he had been very sickly as a child. So he drew upon a number of different systems and modalities that were already existing, but also mimicking animal-type motions, observing cats, for instance. And he drew upon his background as a boxer, for instance. So you will see a bunch of different similarities with certain Pilates movements. But I don't teach yoga. I am a yoga practitioner myself. So I do both. I find them very different, but I also find similarities between the two. And typically, you will find in a yoga class, it will end on the ground, where typically most standard Pilates classes will begin on the ground. The intention behind the exercises is very different. Yoga can include a spiritual component of it, but the asanas, which are the poses, are just really one aspect of the bigger picture of yoga. Whereas Pilates does not in itself innately have a spiritual teaching component to it. Pilates also grew out of that rehabilitative component, whereas yoga did not.
Let's talk about the different forms of Pilates, because I know that we mentioned there's mat work, now there's reformers, there's the Pilates chair, there's the Cadillac, you have reformer Cadillac combos. There's so many new kinds of devices that they're coming out with, depending on which company you're looking at. You know, I'm thinking a Balance Body or a Stott. Let's talk about those pieces of equipment, and what are the advantages versus, let's say, just doing simple mat work?
Well, first of all, let's clarify that the reformer, originally known as the universal reformer, is definitely not new. The Pilates chair is not new. These are all the contraptions, so to speak. The Joseph Pilates was originating, again, in the mid-teens of the 20th century. So this is in World War One, and that's something I think is an interesting myth to dispel for people to think that this is some fad. Pilates has been around for nearly a century. And it's a proven system, and it's effective, and it works. However, we do have to consider that for certain injuries or conditions, it's not always appropriate. So that is where it needs to be modified for those with osteoporosis. But the equipment, the benefit goes back to what I was saying before of most of the equipment, for instance, the Cadillac, the tower, the reformer, the Wonder Chair, all involve springs. And those springs are really fantastic because they can either serve to challenge somebody or to assist. So depending on the exercise and the positioning, whether you're upright, whether you're upside down, whether you're lying on your back, whether you're on all fours, will determine, and the exercise itself will determine whether the springs are there to create more challenge or to offer you more assistance to perform an exercise. So for instance, say you can't do a full squat just normally. Well, you could do something with the springs that might assist you. You could also, for instance, if you're injured, here's a perfect example. Say you're injured and you really need to do some leg strengthening, but you've sprained your ankle. Well, there's exercises that you can actually do using the equipment that you can still condition yourself while still resting that foot, for instance.
Yeah, because I notice, Rebecca, in a lot of the reformers, some will say rehab reformers versus regular reformers. Is it the difference in height that makes the difference between the two?
Not really the height, to be honest. The height is what assists the instructor or the practitioner. First of all, it would be about the tension of the spring, but it would also be about the configuration of the machines. With a rehab reformer, there will be more options and there will be more adaptability in terms of positioning of the piece of equipment so that you have the option to change the angles. It comes down to physics, basically, of degrees of load, degrees of force, angles of joint positioning. And so the more options you have in terms of how you can adapt the piece of equipment to somebody's body, the more capacity it has for rehabilitation.
Now, this is something I assume you're an instructor. You would recommend if somebody's starting out in Pilates, maybe they get instruction, because I know control of breath, the different movements. If you don't know what you're doing, you can injure yourself.
Most definitely. I think it's important for people as much as possible to have private instruction or at least very small group attention, because it's almost like you're learning a new language. And you're also trying to reprogram old habits. So if you're used to always walking in a certain way and that's causing you some problems, then you have to rewire your circuitry. And I like to explain the Pilates system, but not just Pilates, all sorts of movement education that I deal with, as rewiring your circuitry. Initially, it's a conscious effort to think, oh, I have to think of pulling in such and such area of my body or activating such muscle or breathing in this way while I'm doing such and such exercises. But then it becomes more unconscious. So it starts out as a conscious state, but then it becomes more automated. And without any kind of awareness of how you perform certain exercises or what you might be doing, you might just be reinforcing old patterns, especially if you're coming to this because of a pain or because of an injury. There's something that got you there in the first place. Perhaps it was an impact injury, right? Or you fell. But more often than not, it's just a repetitive injury. There wasn't something that led to the fact that you now have pain when you lift your arm up overhead. But it's a repetitive action. You can do it for years and years. And then after, you know, the thousandth time that you're doing something in a certain way, your body says, okay, no more. And so you have to relearn or repattern the way that you're performing that movement. And that's where the private instruction can come in really handy, because it can say, oh, this is what you're doing, and this is what will be helpful for you to do instead, so that you can learn a more efficient and a more effective way of doing it to get the most out of the movement or to reduce your pain.
So we talked about the advantages, and you've developed a program specifically using Pilates designed to combat or aid in osteoporosis. Tell us about that.
Well, going back to what we're talking about with Pilates, Pilates is a fantastic modality, a fantastic movement system for strengthening, for increasing flexibility, coordination, awareness. So when people have osteoporosis, one of the biggest concerns is obviously fracturing a bone, right? That you're more susceptible to fracture. And when it comes to the spine, which is one of the most common types of fracture for those with osteoporosis, the fractures are usually silent. So people don't realize the problem, because it's not like there's pain that's notifying you. And one of the most unsafe movements that can induce a fracture is a forward bending of your back, like curving your back forward. It's called spinal flexion, and it's something that needs to be modified or avoided. And let me first remove any preconceived notion or misunderstanding when people come to me and say, oh, I've been told I can't bend forward. What do I do about picking something off the ground or tying my shoe? we're talking about bending your back. Now, if you bend at your hips, in other words, you know, your hips are, if you sit down in a chair, that's the crease right there, the hip fold. That's fine. That's healthy. But we're talking about bending your spine. That's what you don't want to do. And unfortunately, about 3/4 of the exercises in Pilates involve movement through the spine because there's a lot of emphasis on spinal mobility and articulation. And that does need to be modified for those with osteoporosis in order to stay safe. But I also found that while Pilates was great, there are other components that needed to be integrated. There needed to be more emphasis on balance. There needed to be more standing work because we talked about the importance before of weight bearing and how all the bones of the body, the skeleton, including the spine, including the hips, which are, again, the other two really most common for osteoporosis, those sites of the body needed to be integrated because the osteoporosis research shows the importance of what we call being site specific. So exercising and targeting the sites of the body that are most vulnerable to fracture. So that's one of the things that I did with my program. I also brought in other types of movement. I brought in more functional training. I brought in some therapeutic exercises. I brought in some strength training movements. Again, based on the research has shown the importance of strength training, but we also know the importance of control and the significance of balance to prevent falls. And interesting new research, a consensus that just came out last year, shows protocols that are recommended for the medical community for osteoporosis involve exactly what we're doing in our Buff Bones training system, which is involving what they call multimodal components. So using different aspects. So that's really, before this came out, this is something that, you know, I was seeing from research and also just from my own experience as a movement educator, made sense to be bringing in for osteoporosis, strengthening flexibility, the core control, the coordination, the balance, but these different types of movement that would also be very applicable to your daily living so that it would translate outside the exercise studio into your daily life, including awareness of your body, including additional loads and additional weight that you wouldn't get in Pilates, and also integration of feet. Because again, I can't emphasize enough of the significance and the importance of the feet.
Rebecca, let me ask you this. A number of years ago, I had a reformer Cadillac combination, got into advanced movements in Pilates, and there was a particular exercise I did. I think it was called the plow, where I really injured myself and developed sciatica as a result of the injury. You know, I've gotten rid of it, but what are the limitations? I guess as we age, perhaps there's a limitation on the number of things that we can do. I guess we keep thinking that we're still young, but we're not.
Well, I think that it's not always a matter of age, but also level and individuality. So there's all sorts of advanced exercises within the Pilates repertoire, which you can get away with perhaps not having the most ideal form when you're younger, but when you're a little bit older, your body might not be quite so lenient and forgiving. And this is also where I think when people ask, you know, what does an appropriate Pilates program look like? Or for instance, for osteoporosis, for anything, I always think it's very age dependent. It depends on what your age is. It depends on your physical level and it depends on your previous activity. And so, for instance, the exercise that I think that you're probably referring to is something where you rolled over, send your hips overhead, feet in the air, you're rolling all your body weight onto your shoulder blades. And that's an exercise that does take a certain amount of flexibility. It's most definitely contraindicated, by the way, for somebody with osteoporosis. It's a pretty good way to possibly have a fracture of your spine. But if that's not a concern of yours, it just depends on what it is that you've done to achieve that in the first place. So in other words, how well prepared are you to perform that exercise? And so you want to make sure that you're working with an instructor who has significant training, who is trained in, also ideally knows about certain conditions. So if you come in and you say, you know, I should let you know, I have had a history of a disc herniation, or, you know, I have had a hip replacement or a knee replacement, that your instructor has some kind of understanding of what should be avoided or what would be helpful to be strengthening in that case. How to take those issues into consideration. Because as we get older, you know, we do have more likelihood of different situations. I mean, how many people over 50 do know with stenosis, right? Really common issues are rotator cuff strains, bursitis, these things that just increase in propensity as we get older. And very frequently can be avoided through exercise, but also how they can be assisted through exercise. And so the more informed and educated the instructor is that you're working with, the better off you're going to be.
So, Rebecca, as we sum up here, there's a lot of advantages, as you have proven, for aiding in the prevention or at least alleviating some of the problems of osteoporosis. In generality, as we age, the importance of maintaining bone strength and flexibility to avoid injury, what would be your recommendations? Is it something that a listener should go see their doctor first and say, I'm thinking of getting involved in this kind of program? I know they tell you to do that if you're going to get involved in a serious exercise program. Should you begin with your doctor and then try to get private instruction or get a class and inform your instructor that, hey, I have certain issues health-wise, whether it's a fractured hip or a broken bone or something like that?
Yes. And in fact, I think that's a great protocol, is to first check with your doctor to advise them about what you're looking to do. One of the challenges that I have to admit is that many physicians are not familiar with some of the protocols with osteoporosis when it comes to exercise, in terms of going to just a Pilates class, if you have osteoporosis, is possibly going to do more harm than good. Because a traditional Pilates class will involve these exercises where you're rolling onto your back. If you have osteoporosis, that could possibly create a fracture. So Pilates can be terrific, but you need to be either going to a class that is safe for those with osteoporosis. For instance, just the reason why I created the Buff Bone program itself, to offer that option. But you can also, if you're working with an instructor, check that your instructor has taken training in osteoporosis and just to know the safety protocol. But when you go to the doctor, part of my mission has been to work with physicians and to help them understand that, first of all, to tell their patients that exercise is an option in addition to any medications that they might be prescribing, to tell them about physical activity, but also to explain to them about the safety concerns with exercise so that people don't just go and take a type of class that could be potentially dangerous for them. So yes, first though, talking to the doctor. Second, finding an instructor who is trained in osteoporosis safety. And then third, informing, as you stated, informing your instructor of any injuries and conditions you have, but also you will probably want to be careful to tell them about medications that you're on, because there might be certain blood pressure medications for which certain movements, certain inversions, for instance, not necessarily with your feet up in the air, but just with your head lower than your heart. If your butt is up in the air, your hands are down on the ground, sort of like a downward dog type of movement, that you might get dizzy. So you just want to keep your instructor informed of your current health status. I think that's important, that there's a full community of healthcare practitioners, so that you're working with your physician, you're working with your exercise professionals, and that there's communication between all of them.
Well, I can't emphasize how important that is, because like I know in my own case, I thought I was much younger than I was, doing a lot more movements I probably shouldn't have been doing, and the result was an injury. Well, Rebecca, if our listeners would like to follow your work or find out more about the information about how Pilates can help osteoporosis or maintain bone strength and flexibility as they age, how could they do so?
You can go to the website buff-bones.com. Buff, obviously meaning strong, slang for strong. And that is the site where I have information about the Buff Bone system of exercise. But also you can find an instructor that is near you. We do have licensed instructors around the country and actually in more than 20 countries that are teaching this system of movement.
Well, listen, Rebecca, thanks for joining us on the program. We appreciate your time and efforts, and all the best to you. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Jim.
You're welcome.
It's amazing, Jim, how much lifestyle plays and the guests we've had here on the program, lifestyle and taking care of your health. You know, I tell some of these guys I run into at the gym that are in their 20s, I said, you know, if you take care of your bodies now and don't believe that you're going to live forever type of thing, your bodies will thank you when they're 50 and 60 and 70 and 80, because later on you'll discover you can break. So lifestyle is a very, very important way of dealing with things, right?
Yeah, and also, as you get older, too, when you do break, it doesn't heal as quickly. So, but, you know, it's amazing, John, through all this science and medicine that we have, you know, people are living longer, and we are finding the lifestyles that we lead, stress in our life, the type of diets that we have in terms of creating disease. As we've had several authors on this program, almost 80-something percent of all disease starts in your gut. So, folks, really pay attention to your diet and try to stay and maintain a healthy lifestyle. Exercise daily, even if it's a brisk walk, or do something to keep yourself healthy. I mean, why work all your life, save up for retirement, and not be able to enjoy it because of poor health? Anyway, as always, we've run out of time again. We have a lot of great shows coming up here in the weeks ahead. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.